My name is Pete Buttigieg. I'm a proud son of South Bend, Indiana, and I am running for president of the United States. The horror show in Washington is mesmerizing. It's all-consuming. But starting today, we're going to change the channel.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappelle. Marriage equality debuts in Japan's court system, European Lesbian Conference overcomes tear gas-toting protesters, and Buttigieg's presidential bid breaks into the big time. Those stories and more this week, now that you've tuned in to This Way Out.
I'm Michael Lebeau.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending April 20th, 2019. A court in Japan began hearing the country's first lawsuit challenging the definition of civil marriage as exclusively heterosexual. Article 24 of the nation's constitution says that marriage shall be based only on the mutual consent of both sexes. 13 couples filed the lawsuit on Valentine's Day. They range in age from their 20s to 60s. In addition to ending Japan's marriage inequality, they're demanding financial compensation of 1 million yen and all trial costs. On the first day of the trial, two of the plaintiffs described the challenges they face every day, including social stigma in the conservative country. 40-year-old breast cancer survivor Haru Ono has been with her partner for 14 years. She discussed the difficulties the couple faced during her treatment when the hospital denied her partner the right to participate in medical decision-making. She said that in addition to facing life-threatening illness, she had to worry about parental custody and inheritance issues involving the three children from previous heterosexual marriages that the couple has been raising. Gay plaintiff Aikuo Sato is HIV positive and also worried about medical treatment and inheritance issues. As if to demonstrate Japan's continuing social stigma, his deeply closeted partner is not a part of the lawsuit and has not been in the courtroom. The first day of the trial was a genuine baby step. One of the lawyers for the couples, Shigenori Nakagawa, said that it could be up to 5 years before any ruling is announced.
Meanwhile, 157 same-gender couples are planning to apply for marriage licenses in Taiwan on May 24th. That's the deadline set by the Constitutional Court 2 years ago when it ordered that civil marriage be opened to lesbian and gay couples. The legislative yuan has been unable to pass the necessary legislation thus far, and the court said that marriage equality would automatically come into force on May 24, 2019, if lawmakers fail to act by then. The Coalition for the Happiness of Our Next Generation, the conservative Christian group that sponsored referenda on the November ballot, is calling on legislators to adhere to the results. Voters rejected marriage equality while supporting less-than-marriage civil unions. No one can predict what will happen between now and May 24th.
About 35 far-right religious zealots protested the start on April 11th in the Ukrainian capital of Kiev of the European Lesbian Conference. They blocked the entrance to the hotel and held signs saying, "Homosexuality is a disease," and "Go back to hell, sodomites." Some of the protesters tried to break into the hotel carrying tear gas canisters, but police were able to hold them off. They still broke windows and scrawled homophobic slogans on the walls outside. The ultimately successful conference went on with heightened security. Organizers said about 350 people from 40 countries attended the three-day event. "Are you scared?" one of the first speakers asked the crowd, which drew a loud chorus of "No." Another speaker said that the protesters only represented a small minority of people in Ukraine. "The majority are too busy trying to make ends meet to care about us lesbians," she said. "It's our goal to make sure they don't end up joining those protesters."
At least 11 people with red tape across their mouths were arrested in the Russian city of St. Petersburg on April 17th during an annual Day of Silence for Sexual and Gender Equality. According to organizers, about 45 people participated. The event is a student-led action to highlight the silencing and erasure of LGBTQ communities across Russia. The detainees, other than having red tape over their mouths, were walking peacefully toward the Church of the Savior when police took each of them into custody. They carried no placards nor other LGBTQ-identifying symbols. The police claimed that the arrests were for violating administrative code regulations governing rallies, But activists say that individuals don't need government permission to walk down the street and that the arrests were illegal. One of them blamed right-wing homophobes for calling the police.
Police in oppressively anti-queer Malaysia have been questioning activist Numan Afifi about a speech he gave at a United Nations conference in Geneva last month, highlighting discrimination against the LGBTQ community. It came during the UN Human Rights Commission's Universal Periodic Review of the Southeast Asian nation. "The statement I read," he told the Star News outlet, "was made on behalf of a coalition of 12 Malaysian organizations that work on gender identity and sexual orientation. We commended the government for its anti-bullying campaign in schools," he said, "but raised concerns that Malaysia has rejected many other recommendations to improve its treatment of LGBTQ people." He added that, "I will not bow down to these acts to harass or intimidate me as a human rights defender in Malaysia." He said he's yet to hear from police officials about any resolution of their so-called investigation.
Among the latest actions against Brunei and its ruling sultan over new laws punishing gay sex with death by stoning, the European Parliament adopted a resolution this week calling on the tiny Southeast Asian nation and its ruler to repeal them. The final stages in Brunei's complete conversion to Islamic law, or Sharia, became effective on April 3rd. The new Sharia-based penal code also punishes some other offenses with amputation. The Europarlament's Vice President Federica Mogherini said that no crime justifies an amputation or torture, and no person should be punished for loving someone. That can never be interpreted as a crime. But European lawmakers stopped short of punitive measures. Some had called for the freezing of assets of the Sultan and his family, visa bans, and the blacklisting of 9 luxury hotels that the royals own. Brunei officials continue to defend the harsh new laws. Government statements claim that such severe enforcement will be rare and that whippings will be conducted only with moderate force. You can find a list of those 9 luxury hotels and more about the ongoing boycott of all things Brunei at thiswayout.org.
The fallout continues from Donald Trump's ban on qualified transgender enlistees in the U.S. Armed Forces. The nation's military academies will not be admitting new transgender students under the new Pentagon policy that took effect on April 12th. The Naval Academy has announced that it will reject transgender applicants starting with the 2020 school year. A spokesman said the Air Force Academy would conform to Defense Department policy when admitting future cadets. The Coast Guard Academy in New London, Connecticut, confirmed that it would also stop admitting trans candidates. The U.S. Military Academy and the U.S. Merchant Marine Academy are expected to fall in line in short order.
Meanwhile, at the University of Texas at Austin, a second-year scholarship cadet in ROTC, the Reserve Officers Training Corps, has now lost his scholarship. 19-year-old trans man Map Pesqueira has had top surgery and takes hormones to support his transition. He's been studying to be a filmmaker and was looking forward to serving in the Army. He told reporters that the ROTC Army Department chair at the University of Texas asked the Defense Department for a grandfather exemption to let Pesqueira continue in the program and keep his scholarship. Those exemptions have been given to some active duty trans troops who've already transitioned or are in the process, but the request was denied. Since his story broke in the Texan Daily newspaper, a GoFundMe page has been helping Pesqueira cover the costs of his continued education. He reportedly raised more than $6,500 in the first 5 days. His goal is $20,000. In an email message to Gay Star News, Pesqueira said that he is extremely grateful to be supported by so many people who are rooting for me.
And finally, more than 5,000 people have signed an online petition urging administrators of Taylor University, an evangelical Christian college in Mike Pence's home state of Indiana, to dump the vice president as commencement speaker because his professed religious beliefs are not consistent with the Christian ethic of love we hold dear. Honoring Pence and giving him a coveted platform for his political views, the Change.org petition says, makes our alumni, faculty, staff, and current students complicit in the Trump-Pence administration's policies. Out 2007 Taylor University alumnus Alex Hoekstra started the petition. He told NBC News that the Trump-Pence administration's policies don't represent Christianity, Jesus, or the Bible. The school's student newspaper, The Echo, reported that 61 of the university's 113 faculty members supported a motion of dissent when Pence's selection as graduation speaker was announced, but university administrators are sticking by Pence. One of the more ridiculous reactions to the petition from the far right came from televangelist Franklin Graham. apparently not wanting to cloud the issue with facts, he asked instead on his Facebook page, what are these people smoking?
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending April 20th, 2019. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazer, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast.
And now you can be the first on your block to hear News Wrap each week by subscribing to our This Way Out Radio YouTube channel. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm John Dyer V.
Back home again in Indiana, and it seems that I can see.
The only thing growing faster than South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg's popularity among Democratic hopefuls for the U.S. presidency is the number of Democrats who have also thrown their hats into the ring. 19 so far. In an April 18th poll by the mid-level-ranked group Change Research, Buttigieg placed third below former Vice President Joe Biden and 2016 Democratic runner-up Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. The as-yet-undeclared Biden has dropped 15% since the last Change Research poll in March, while Buttigieg has seen a 15% rise. Mayor Pete officially announced his candidacy to become the first openly gay U.S. president at an April 14th rally in his hometown.
I'm here to join you to make a little news. My name is Pete Buttigieg. They call me Mayor Pete. I'm a proud son of South Bend, Indiana, and I am running for president of the United States. The principles that will guide my campaign for president are simple enough to fit on a bumper sticker. Freedom, security, and democracy. First comes freedom, something our conservative friends have come to think of as their own. But let me tell you, freedom does not belong to just one political party. Freedom has been Democratic bedrock ever since the New Deal. Freedom from want, freedom from fear. Our conservative friends care about freedom, but they only make it part of the way. They only see freedom from taxes, freedom from regulation, as though government were the only thing that can make somebody unfree. But it's not true. Your neighbor can make you unfree. Your cable company can make you unfree. Your freedom depends on a lot more than just the size of your government. Healthcare is freedom, because you're not free if you can't start a small business when leaving your job means losing your healthcare. Consumer protection is freedom, because you're not free if you can't sue your credit card company even after they get caught ripping you off. Racial justice is freedom, because you're not free if there's a veil of mistrust between people of color and the officers sworn to keep us safe. Women's equality is freedom. Because you're not free if your reproductive health choices are dictated by male politicians or bosses. Organized labor sows freedom, because you're not free if you can't organize for a fair day's pay for a good day's work. And take it from Chasten and me. You're not free if a county clerk gets to tell you who you ought to marry because of their idea, their political beliefs. The chance to live a life of your choosing, in keeping with your values, that is freedom in its richest sense. And we know that good government secures freedom just as much as bad government denies it. Now let's talk about security. There is a lot more to safety and security than putting up a wall from sea to shining sea. To those in charge of our border policy, I want to make this clear. The greatest nation in the world should have nothing to fear from children fleeing violence. And even more importantly, children fleeing violence ought to have nothing to fear from the greatest country in the world. Security means keeping us safe in the face of violent white nationalism rearing its ugly head around the country and around the world. And let's pick our heads up to face what might be the greatest security issue of our time, climate change and climate disruption. No region of our country is immune to that threat. We've seen it in the floods in Nebraska, the tornadoes in Alabama, the hurricane in Puerto Rico, and the fires in California. And we're not even having a contest over whose climate plan is better, because only one side brought forth any plans at all. Our economy is on the line, our future is on the line, lives are on the line. So let's call this what it is: climate security, a life and death issue for our generation. And now let's talk about democracy. Our democratic republic is an elegant system, but lately it hasn't been quite democratic enough. It's not democratic enough if legitimate voters are denied the ability to exercise their rights because one side thinks as a matter of political strategy that they're better off if fewer citizens are able to vote. It is hardly democracy if Citizens United means that dollars can drown out the will of the people. It's not much of a republic if our districts are drawn so that politicians get to choose their voters instead of the other way around. It's nowhere near the democracy that I swore to protect with my life when U.S. citizens from Washington, D.C. to Puerto Rico don't even have the same political representation as the rest of us. And we can't say it's much of a democracy when twice in my lifetime the Electoral College has overruled the American people. So let's make it easier to register and to vote. Let's make our districts fairer. Let's make our courts less political. Our structures more inclusive. And yes, let's pick our president by counting up all the ballots and giving it to the woman or man who got the most votes. The horror show in Washington is mesmerizing. It's all-consuming. But starting today, we're going to change the channel.
After outlining his policy agenda, Buttigieg changed the channel to talk about how his personal journey led to his decision to run for president.
We stand on the shoulders of optimistic women and men. Women and men who knew that optimism is not a lack of knowledge, it is a source of courage. And it will take courage to move on from our past. We're not going back. You know, if I did get a chance to go back, it wouldn't be out of a desire to live in that past. If I went into the past, I'd go just 20 years back. So I could find a teenage boy in the basement of his parents' brick house, thinking long thoughts as he played the same guitar lick over and over again on his little Stratocaster, wondering how he could belong in this world. Wondering if his intellectual curiosity means he'll never fit in. Wondering if his last name will be a stumbling block for the rest of his life. Wondering what it means when he sometimes feels a certain way about young men he sees in the hall at school. If it means he'll never wear the uniform, never be accepted, never know love. If I found him and told him what was ahead, would he believe me? I can picture it if I could put my arm around him and tell him that he was going to see the world and serve his country, that he would not only find belonging in his hometown, but be entrusted by its citizens with the duty of leading it and shaping it. That he would have a hand in transforming the neighborhoods he knew as a boy, and that he would help the lights come back on in that giant factory whose broken windows loomed like the faces of a ghost over the ballpark where his dad used to take him to games. Where he wondered if this city was his own. To tell him that he'll be all right. More than all right. To tell him that one rainy April day, before he even turns 40, he'll wake up to headlines about whether he's rising too quickly into becoming a top-tier contender for the American presidency. to tell him that on that day when he announces his campaign for president, he'll do it with his husband looking on. How can you live that story and not believe that America deserves our optimism, deserves our courage, and deserves our hope? Yes, running for office is an act of hope. So is supporting someone running for office. So this afternoon, are you not hopeful? Do we not live in a country that can overcome the bleakness of a challenging and divided moment? Are you ready to turn the page and start a new chapter in the American story? If you join me, if you and I rise together to meet this moment, one day they will write histories, not just about one campaign or one presidency, but about the era that began here today in this building where past, present, and future meet, right here this chilly day in South Bend. So with hope in our hearts and with fire in our bellies, let's get to work and let's make history.
Bet that Mayor Pete Buttigieg's campaign trail will be lined with notable firsts, like his heart-to-heart lesbian journalist-to-gay candidate chat with MSNBC's Rachel Maddow about coming out. Maybe not so groundbreaking to anyone who's been around queer activism for a long time, but ask yourself how many heterosexual voters ever get to hear about the LGBTQ experience from the inside in. This interview perfectly demonstrates the importance of newsroom diversity.
I was the first openly gay American Rhodes Scholar, and I got there, and I had come out in college, so I applied for the Rhodes Scholarship as an openly gay person. It definitely came up in the selection process, and then I got there, and I learned that I was the first American who had ever been out.
Wow.
But that was a decade before you. And you went through college, and then the Rhodes Scholarship process, and getting the Rhodes Scholarship, and going to work for McKinsey, and joining the Navy, and deploying to Afghanistan, and coming home, and running for mayor in your hometown, and getting elected before you came out at the age of 33.
Yeah.
And I bring this up, and I acknowledge it's a difficult question, not because it's bad that you didn't come out to your 33, but I think it would have killed me to be closeted for that long. Yeah. I just think about what it takes as a human being to know something and to have to bifurcate your public life. And for you to have had all of those difficult transitions and experiences and to be aiming as high as you were all of that time and not coming out until your early 30s, I just wonder if that was hurtful to you, if it hurt you to do it.
It was hard. It was really hard.
Coming out is hard, but being in the closet is harder.
Yeah, no, that's what I mean. I mean, it was and it wasn't. First of all, it took me plenty of time to come out to myself. So I did not, the way you did or the way my husband did, figure out at such an early age that I probably should have. I mean, there's certain plenty of indications by the time I was 15 or so that I could point back and be like, this kid's gay. I guess I just really needed to not be. And, you know, there's this war that breaks out, I think, inside a lot of people when they realize that they might be something they're afraid of. Mm-hmm. And it took me a very long time to resolve that. I did make sure, as a kind of final way of coming out to myself, to come out to at least a couple of people in my life before I took office, because I knew that I didn't want to have that kind of psychological pressure, or at least not being out to somebody. It was really the deployment that put me over the top. I realized that you only get to be one person. You don't know how long you have on this earth. And by the time I came back, I realized, like, I gotta do something.
Were you sure at the time when you came out that it would cost you re-election?
I was pretty sure it was going to be a big complication, but I had no idea. I mean, I felt like things were going well in the city. I felt like I'd done a good job by the people of South Bend, and I had some level of trust that I would be rewarded for that with a re-election. But there's no way to really know. There was no playbook. I mean, no executive in Indiana had ever been out, and so it was kind of a leap of faith. And I just, you know, I wrote it all down, put it in an op-ed. Dropped it in the South Bend Tribune and woke up that day and saw what would happen.
And then got reelected with 80% of the vote.
And then there you go. Yeah. So you treat people, you trust people, and at least in this case, they reciprocated that trust. And, you know, that was more than I got elected in the first place. I guess it's one thing that gives me a lot of encouragement. I mean, don't get me wrong. There's plenty of ugliness that comes in from all over the place. But most people, I think, are either supportive or even enthusiastic about the idea of the first out person going this far. Or they find a way to let me know they don't care. Mm-hmm. And that's historic, too. One of the things that I think I can do before the first vote is cast is maybe make it a little easier just by being here
right.
For the next person who comes along.
I've had a number of conversations with people since the Rachel Maddow interview.
Me too.
Some are furious that she asked the question at all. Lesbians.
Ann Northrup and Andy Hum of Gay USA discussed reactions to Maddow's interview with Buttigieg and how focus on that media moment might serve to mask some more dubious aspects of Mayor Pete's record.
I think there is certainly something to be discussed in terms of his process, and we don't agree on all of this, but to me it portrays quite vividly for the American people, because he talks about his fear and not wanting to be this. And I think that just echoes what I have observed over the years, which is those with the most privilege, those with the most ambition, those most invested in the status quo are the most fearful. It also distracts us from a lot of Pete's actual political history and opinions about issues. And there are those who are paying attention and saying, you know, he did some South Bend redevelopment that really threw a lot of people of color out of their houses and was too fast. And even Pete has said, well, maybe we didn't do that the right way. And he fired a black police chief and people have gotten on him about that. And he said, I regret that.
Stephen Thrasher, an African-American gay journalist, wrote, this candidacy is going to expose fault lines between the white gay men and the rest of the LGBT community. And he says, queer America is a lot to the left of the white married gay God-fearing centrist. And Sarah Schulman, who's more radical, also made similar comments. She says, I'm not criticizing this individual who has become himself, but I am disappointed that militarism, God, and marriage is what we have to do to be taken seriously.
Well, you know, I do think it's an evolution in people's thinking and understanding, and I think it is unimaginable that he, as an out gay man, could have run until about now.
That was Ann Northrup and Andy Hum of Gay USA. Whether or not the social and economic fault lines in the LGBT community will prove to be as deep and destructive as those in the larger U.S. society, and the impact that could have on presidential politics, remains to be seen. It's worth noting that the current top trio in the Democratic presidential primary campaign is the all-white boy band of Biden, Bernie, and Buttigieg. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Michael LeBeau and John Dyer V, produced with Brian DeShazer. Jim Nabors and ANAF performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks to the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, Paul Bannon, Richard Merck, and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley, and all of the listener donors who make this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email TWORadio on AOL.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out crew, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KXSU Seattle, Washington, to MTM Coonamble, New South Wales, WDIY Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and some 200 stations and other outlets around the world, including this one. Now y'all stay tuned.